Hi, I'm Daniel Lucas.
And this is Mick, the Doctor of Digital.
And welcome to Music 101. Music 101 is created to empower music, music itself, and legendary icon in the music industry. Another week, another great episode. America sang before it forgot who it was. Music, masculinity, love, and the loss of cultural memory, part one.
Yes, indeed. Every culture writes itself into song before it writes itself into history. The ballads come first, before the constitutions, before the manifestos, before the monuments. And in America, that truth runs deeper than almost anywhere else on earth, because this nation has invented, conceived in revolution, forged in contradiction, and held together by ideals and ambition, producing a spectacular set of stories we agreed to sing. For 250 years, Americans had been singing their way toward the South. They haven't quite finished building. They've sung about war and belonging, about the land and who it belongs to, about the kind of man you're supposed to be when you stand on it. They've sung about women they've loved and wars they didn't choose, about hometowns that haunt them and a red, white, and blue flag that means everything. They sung from the cotton field and the factory floor, from the Dust Bowl Road and the jungles of Vietnam, from the church pew in the street corner. We want to say today that take these songs as the most instructive recordings across the full sweep of American history and use them as lenses through which we can see how American identity, masculinity, romantic love, and the search for meaning have shifted, contradicted themselves, and endured across three centuries. In conclusion, we are going to cover a lot of ground, so buckle in.
Indeed, buckling people. And Mr. Mick, I want to start the very beginning because I've always found this one strangely fascinating. Yankee Doodle. Every kid learns it. It's particularly a nursery rhyme. But what's actually going on in that song? It seems almost too silly to be taken seriously as a founding document of anything.
That silliness is the whole point, and it's one of the most sophisticated moves in the history of political music. Here's what most people don't know. Yankee Doodle was not written by Americans as a rallying cry. It was written about Americans by British soldiers as an insult. The song dates back to at least the mid-1750s during the French and Indian War, and the Redcoats sang it to mock the colonial militiamen they were fighting alongside. Ragged, undisciplined farmers who showed up to war without proper uniforms or military bearing. The word Yankee was itself a British slur for New Englanders, likely derived from the Dutch diminutive Janka, meaning something like Little John, contemptuous, dismissive. Doodle was a British slang for a fool or simpleton. Macaroni, in the famous line, refers to the Macaroni Club, a group of London dandies who dressed in extravagant Italian fashion, the joke being that this provincial rube thought sticking a feather in his cap made him sophisticated. The British were essentially singing, "These colonials are so backwards, they think a feather makes them fashionable." Now, here's where the genius enters. At some point during the Revolutionary War, historians debate precisely when, but certainly by 1776, the American colonists decided to take the song back. They embraced it, sang it back at the British, and turned the mockery inside out. The earliest printed American version appeared in a 1775 Massachusetts newspaper, and by the time Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown in 1781, legend holds that the British marched out to the world turned upside down, while the Continental Army played Yankee Doodle right back at them. They had taken the weapon of ridicule and made it a banner. This is a profound act of cultural reclamation, and it establishes something fundamental about American identity from the very beginning, meaning that it's a willingness to absorb contempt and metabolize it into pride. It's a pattern that will repeat itself throughout American cultural history, in American blues and working class country music, in punk rock and hip hop. The outsider takes the insult and makes it a badge. The masculinity embedded in this act is not the polished military masculinity of the British officer corps. It is the rough, anti-hierarchical masculinity of the frontiersman who does not need your approval and finds your snobbery amusing. Scholar Robert Winans, writing in the Journal of the American Musicological Society, has noted that the song's deliberately simple, almost mocking melody is part of its defiant charm. It refuses to be grand. It refuses to genuflect. That refusal is the original American posture, and it will still echo forward two centuries all the way to Woody Guthrie writing folk songs on a battered guitar and Johnny Cash recording live at Folsom Prison, both of them choosing rough edges over polish because rough edges are, in America, a form of honesty. It is also worth noting that the song accumulated more than 150 verses in its various documented versions, verses added by American soldiers and civilians over decades to mock the British, celebrate American victories, and satirize everyone from Tory sympathizers to politicians who had grown too comfortable in their new offices. The song kept growing because the American habit of irreverent self-expression kept finding new targets from its very first iteration. Yankee Doodle was a living, democratic, ungovernable text, the kind of song that belongs to whoever picks it up and decides to add a verse. No committee approved it. No king commissioned it. It grew in the mouths of ordinary people, which is exactly what it was about. In conclusion, what Yankee Doodle teaches us is that American identity was forged not in triumph, but in the willingness to be laughed at and to laugh back. And the story of American music is, from its very first chapter, a story about who gets to define the terms of self-respect.
Well said, Mr. Meek. Let's move to the national anthem, because I think most people don't realize how contested and strange its original really are. Most people just know it's the thing they stand up for the ball game. What is the full story?
The full story is a near miracle of accident and irony, which makes it perfectly American. Francis Scott Key was a Georgetown lawyer who, on September 13, 1814, found himself aboard a British truce vessel in the Chesapeake Bay as a negotiator trying to secure the release of a captured American civilian named Dr. Rob William Beans. He watched the British fleet bombard Fort McHenry for 25 consecutive hours, and in the dawn's early light, through the smoke and the September rain, he saw the American garrison flag still flying. He was so moved that he wrote a poem on the back of a letter in his coat pocket, Defense of Fort McHenry, that was published in Baltimore newspapers within days and quickly set to music. What Key did not write from scratch was the tune. He set his words to Anacreon in Heaven, a drinking song associated with the Anacreonic Society, a London gentleman's music club. It was a notoriously difficult melody to sing, with a range of nearly two octaves, which is why every Super Bowl performance becomes an athletic event in itself. Critically, the song was not declared the official national anthem until 1931. For over a century, various songs competed for the role, including My Country, Tis of Thee, which borrowed its tune directly from God Save the King. But here's where the layer that has opened the anthem to its deepest reconsideration. Key writes about hireling and slave meeting their fate in battle, and while scholars debate the precise reading, the historical context is not obscure. For the better part of 150 years, Americans did not have a fixed official national anthem. They had candidates, competing songs that different regions, different generations, and different political factions preferred. That openness, that absence of official decree, reflects something genuinely pluralistic about American civic culture. The anthem was chosen by acclamation over time, and the fact that a drinking song's melody ultimately won the competition is either deeply embarrassing or deeply appropriate, depending on your view of American civilization. When Jimi Hendrix played it at Woodstock in August 1969, bending the melody into something that sounded like bombs falling and feedback screaming across a hillside in upstate New York, he was not vandalizing the anthem. He was, in the direct tradition of Yankee Doodle, reclaiming it and making it carry throughs for the age of Aquarius. His guitar said what no lyric could. This song has been carried into a war that is tearing us apart, and we are going to reckon with that together. This song is personal to me as well. Our supervisor at the radio station back in the day thought we young guys were not patriotic enough and insisted that the Star-Spangled Banner be played at the opening of each broadcast day. This was before the days of 24-hour entertainment, but we young punks conspired to give the supervisor something he hadn't bargained for. We plotted, well, he wants the national anthem, so the anthem is what he will get. What he hadn't anticipated, though, was that we would play the Jimi Hendrix version of the tune. After the first day, and totally red-faced, the boss man never asked to play the song again. We played it loud, and we played it proud. We were patriots, but we were patriotic in our own contemporary manner. And then there is Whitney Houston's 1991 Super Bowl performance, which remains the single greatest vocal achievement in the anthem's history, a rendition so luminous and so perfectly controlled that it was released as a commercial single and charted in the top 10 twice upon its original release and again after September 11, 2001, when a grieving nation reached for it instinctively. Whitney turned the anthem into gospel, a triumphalism of greatness and the soaring, aching hopefulness of a people who had to fight for every inch of the promise. It is worth sitting with the full weight of that. Whitney Houston sang the national anthem of her country, grateful as though it were a love song because she had chosen it freely, which may be the most extravagant example of grace for all of us in the history of American music. It is also worth remembering that she recorded the performance in advance, not live, a detail that has fueled decades of argument among music fans, and that ultimately does not matter at all, because what she delivered was not a spontaneous outburst, but a perfectly constructed, completely controlled act of artistic intention. That discipline, that preparation, that refusal to leave greatness to chance, that too is an American value, and it sounds like the national anthem when it is done right. In conclusion, the Star Spangled Banner is a hymn to an accomplished nation and a question posed each time it is sung. Is the flag still there? And the fact that different Americans hear such radically different answers is not the anthem's failure, but its strange, unresolved power to each generation.
Mr. Mink, let's look at the two songs most often proposed as alternatives to the anthem, America, the Beautiful, and the Land is Your Land. They feel like they are come from very different emotional places. What is the real relationship between them?
They are in explicit dialogue with each other, and understanding that dialogue tells you nearly everything about the fault lines in American political culture, fault lines that have not moved much in 150 years. America the Beautiful was written by Catherine Lee Bates, a professor of English literature at Wellesley College, who composed the original poem in the summer of 1893 after a transcontinental train journey that culminated at the summit of Pikes Peak in Colorado. What she saw from 14,000 feet moved her to her core, the vast golden sweep of the Great Plains, the purple mountain majesty of the Rockies, the fruited valleys stretching to either coast. She was not writing propaganda. She was writing a love letter and a prayer. The crucial word in her lyric is, God mend thine every flaw. This is aspiration. It is a reformer's prayer, the voice of the gospel movement that was reshaping American Protestantism in the 1890s. A movement that insisted the Christian gospel had direct implications for overcoming poverty, providing labor, and justice. The vision of America in her song is aspirational and inspirational. Americans demand that we live up to our aspirations. What is often overlooked is that Bates revised the poem twice, first in 1904 and again in 1913, refining its language and sharpening its theology over 20 years. She was not satisfied with the first draft of either of her poems. The version most Americans sing today is largely the 1913 revision, the work of a woman who had spent two decades thinking about what she meant when she asked God to shed grace on America, and exactly grace would require us to do in return. That sustained act of revision, returning to the same aspiration over and over, making it more precise, demanding more of it, is itself a model for how Americans should relate to their founding ideals. Ray Charles understood this convergence instinctively. His recording of America the Beautiful takes Bates's prayer and pushes it through the entire history of American gospel and soul so that the line, God shed his grace on thee, carries not only theological weight but biographical weight. The grace of a man whose mother died when he was 15, who went blind at 7, who built a career in a country that honored his art and allowed him to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and who stood at the microphone and sang about America's beauty and its honor. That is not naivete. It is a decision, the same kind of decision Catherine Lee Bates made it when she revised her poem for the third time and still kept the word mend. Now, fast forward to 1940. Woody Guthrie, the Oklahoma-born son of Dust Bowl diaspora, was living in a New York City rooming house and listening obsessively to Irving Berlin's God Bless America on the radio, the version Kate Smith made into a cultural phenomenon. Guthrie has another idea. He wants America to be better, so he considers that the sharecroppers were starving and labor organizers were mistreated in the streets. So he writes a song that America is for everyone, even the dispossessed, originally titling it God Bless America for Me, before settling on the familiar title. The original, This Land is Your Land, not the version most school children learn, contains two stanzas that are rarely performed, and that changes the entire meaning of the song. In one, Guthrie stands outside a relief office watching a long line of the hungry turned away and asks, "Was this land made for you and me?" In another, he encounters a no trespassing sign on the one side of a fence, but the other side says nothing at all. And that nothing is Guthrie's statement. This land cannot be privately owned. It belongs to the people who walk it and work it. This is a folk socialist vision in pointed tension with reformist idealism. What links these two songs, despite their differences, is that both treat America and its people, along with its landscape, as a moral actor. The mountains and prairies are not merely scenic. They are signs of what the country is as the people prove worthy of them. That is a religious framework borrowed from the Puritan covenant tradition, and it turns out to be so deeply embedded in the American imagination that it animates both a Wellesley professor and an Okie folk singer. Two people who might have agreed on almost nothing else. In conclusion, America the Beautiful and This Land is Your Land are the two poles of the American civic imagination, one inspiring us upward towards what the land promises, the other reminding us not to forget who has to be included in that promise, and the argument between them is not a flaw in the American Republic, but its most exceptional characteristic.
Very well said, Mr. Mike, and I don't want to skip over the father of American song. What can you say about Stephen Foster? Then, the Civil War was the American song stop being metaphors and start costing people their lives before we finish with the end of the turn of the 19th century.
Stephen Foster stands as the monumental figure of 19th century popular music, essentially the nation's full-time professional songwriter. Writing primarily within the traditions of parlor music and minstrel, Foster captured a distinctly American blend of melancholic singing, longing, domestic warmth, and rhythmic energy. "O Susanna," 1848, captures the gold rush spirit. This track became the unofficial anthem of the California 49ers, echoing out wagons and mining camps across the continent. "Hold Hard Times, Come Again No More," 1854, is a profound, empathetic plea that served as a commonplace song that was the hardscrabble American aspiration for better times. "Beautiful Dreamer," 1864, was published after his tragic, impoverished death. This piece represents the pinnacle of American parlor sentimentality, utilizing a soft, contemplative melodic arc. His song sold hundreds of thousands of copies of sheet music at a time when sheet music was how popular culture traveled, carried home from the music store and played in parlors from Boston to New Orleans. He was, in the truest sense, the first American to make a living entirely from songwriting, and the fact that he died in 1864 at 37 years old, penniless, in a New York City hospital ward, with 38 cents in his pocket and a scrap of paper reading, "Dear Friends and Gentle Hearts," is one of the most poignant and instructive stories in the history of American creative life. The country consumed his art and failed to sustain the man. Not all songwriters and Americans were privileged. The Civil War is the moment in American history when music was its most directly weaponized, when the songs people sang were not metaphors for their politics, but literal instruments of mass mobilization for the bloodiest conflict this country has ever endured. and the three great song traditions of that era, Union, Confederate, and the Spirituals, represent three completely different relationships to the same catastrophe. And all three are still broadcasting on American airwaves today, sometimes simultaneously, sometimes in open collision. The Battle Hymn of the Republic was written by Julia Ward Howe in November 1861, just a few months into the war. She was visiting Union camps near Washington and heard soldiers singing a popular marching tune, John Brown's Body, to a rousing campfire melody. She woke before dawn the following morning with new words forming in her mind, found a pen in the dark, and wrote five stanzas almost by feel, half afraid the words would escape her before full light came. What she wrote is one of the most theologically charged pieces of civic poetry in the English language. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord is the language of apocalyptic prophecy drawn directly from the book of Revelation and the Hebrew prophets. Howe was framing the Union cause as divine judgment, the Civil War as the moment when the God of history was settling accounts for the sin of slavery. The phrase, grapes of wrath, later appropriated by John Steinbeck for his Dust Bowl novel, The Grapes of Wrath, appears in Howe's lyric explicitly. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. The righteous violence of the Union army was being cast as God's own harvest. Abraham Lincoln, when he first heard it performed in public, reportedly wept and asked for it to be sung again immediately. It was published in the Atlantic Monthly in February 1862 and became the Union's defining anthem, a song that told men they were not merely fighting a political war, but participating in a cosmic moral reckoning. The Confederacy had its own answer. Dixie, written in 1859 by Daniel Decatur Emmett, a northern-born minstrel performer from Mount Vernon, Ohio, which tells you everything about the cultural complexity of this period and nothing that reflects well on anyone. Emmett wrote it as a walk-around number for a minstrel show, a genre built entirely on caricatures. It was appropriated by Confederate forces as their unofficial anthem almost from the moment the war began. Jefferson Davis had it played at his inauguration as Confederate president in February 1861. I wish I was in the land of cotton, old times there not forgotten. That longing for the antebellum South is, at its core, nostalgia for a civilization sustained by forced labor, written by a man from Ohio and loved by men who were about to die defending it while not being slaveholders. The head of the household owned slaves, which meant approximately 25 to 26% of families owned at least one slave. But if you divide the raw number of listed individual slaveholders into the entire free Southern population, that number drops to roughly 4.9 to 5%. The irony is bottomless, and the song's cultural legacy, its persistence in Southern identity narratives well into the 20th century, is both a tribute and a tragedy of the long shadows of the war that never fully ended. But another enduring musical tradition of the Civil War era belongs to developing a vast body of sacred song, the spirituals, that function simultaneously as worship, psychological resistance, coded communication, and theological argument. Go Down Moses retells the Exodus narrative as a direct message. Pharaoh is the slaveholder, Moses is the liberator, and the promised land is freedom. Sometimes the North, sometimes Canada, sometimes simply survival with human dignity intact. Frederick Douglass wrote in his 1845 narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass that he had heard these songs from childhood, but only later fully understood how much compressed sorrow they carried and how much coded, disciplined, strategic rage. Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, attributed to the Choctaw freedman Wallace Willis in Indian Territory in the 1860s, uses the image of a heavenly chariot arriving to carry the singer home in a way that worked on at least two registers simultaneously, the promise of divine deliverance after death and the very earthly promise of the Underground Railroad, these bands of angels coming after me, potentially referring to conductors and guides. Harriet Tubman herself reportedly used spirituals as signals during her rescue missions. The voice of the spirituals, the enduring, strategically patient, unbreakable person who encodes resistance because it produced American moral courage. As the century closed, the music began to shift towards localized folk traditions and the early syncopated rhythms that would birth 20th century jazz, blues, and country. James A. Bland was a brilliant professional songwriter who wrote massive international hits like Carry Me Back to Old Virginny and Oh, Dem Golden Slippers. Bland's work asserted artistic authority inside commercial spaces. Dr. Brewster M. Higley's And Home on the Range was originally written as a poem titled My Western Home. This piece evolved into the definitive mythic text of the American West, a pastoral sanctuary of safety and open space far removed from industrial fragmentation. Theodore Roosevelt reportedly named it as his favorite song. Franklin Roosevelt had it played at a White House dinner. Its hold on the American imagination across a century and a half is not nostalgia for a specific place, but for a condition, the condition of freedom that the West represents in the national mythology, real or imagined, and the hunger for open spaces that still drives people West today. Scott Joplin and Maple Leaf Rag arrived right at the turn of the century. Joplin's masterpiece signaled a total civilizational pivot. The syncopated high energy of ragtime broke the old Victorian structures, establishing a brand new rhythmic authority that defined the more modern era. In conclusion, the music of the 19th century reveals that America has always been composed of many who became one, a hall of choruses, and the health of the republic depends on the freedom in the American experiment and listening to what each one is saying.
Indeed, Music 1-1 is talking about the future's America sang before it forgot, with the music, masculinity, love, and loss for cultural memory. These thought-provoking episodes explores how music once reflects a nation's shared values, aspirations, and identity, capturing stories of courage, sacrifice, romance, family, and community across generations. So, Mr. Mick, would you like to plug in something?
I appreciate the opportunity. Write the book, Grow the Business. Connect with me on LinkedIn. G. Mick, the Doctor of Digital Smith, PhD. Listen to the Doctor of Digital podcast and pick up a couple volumes I have on Amazon. Burning America and On Track, Ian Hunter. And if you love music, support true fans.
Indeed, let's support Mr. Mick, the Doctor of Digital, and please do visit our official website, www.universalpodcast.net, for all this website is all the summary of all the podcasts that we are creating, because Mr. Mick and I doing four of them. So please do visit www.universalpodcast.net. And of course, our online radio in the US, Live 365. We do have intended programming over there under the Universal Podcast Network as well, and radio.com in the UK. Please do support us wherever you listen your podcast, our lives every Sunday, and of course, our online radio. And Mr. Mick, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, my friend. Till next time, Deus Vult.
Modicon people, see you soon. Okay, Mr. Mick, let's